This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Swans of Fifth Avenue by Melanie Benjamin. Read for you by Cassandra Campbell and Paul Bamer.
The best time to leave a party is when the party's just beginning. Diana Vreeland.
Languid. Lovely. Lonely. The swans arched their beautiful necks and turned to gaze at him as he stood rooted to the shore, his feet encased in mud. They fluttered their eyelashes, rustled their feathers, and glided over to their leader, the most beautiful of all. There was no sound save the sigh of their graceful bodies drifting across the water. Watching from the shore, wringing his hands, willing himself still, for once, even as he had a childish urge to hop first on one foot, then the other, he was filled with the old fear that he wasn't good enough, brave enough, handsome enough, tall enough, enough. Still, he hoped, he dreamed, he waited, holding his breath. He fixed his gaze upon the most dazzling of them all, the lead swan. Like he was making a birthday wish, he blew his breath toward her and her alone, praying the wind would catch it and carry it to her. A prayer. As she bent her lovely head toward the other swans, she was seen to listen gravely, as if this was a most solemn rite, as if there was no other topic in the world that needed her attention, no wars and deaths and treaties and dilemmas. Only this. His happiness. The other swans whispered. Whispered. One hissed, but he could not tell which it was. Then they broke ranks. They swam into a preordained formation, a perfect arc surrounding their leader, who remained utterly still. Her head bowed in reflection. Then she raised her head, turned, and looked at him, still standing on the shore. They all turned to look. The swans, with one choreographed movement, beckoned to him with their blinding white wings that were arms he saw for the first time. Arms as white as snow leopards, whiter than the pearls around the swan's fragile necks. The lead swan did not beckon, but her eyes, those dark, glittering pools of unfathomable loneliness, never left his as his feet took wing, as he skimmed the surface of the water. Not a swan, no, never would he be one of them. And even then he knew it. He was a nymph, a hovering dragonfly, a sprite, landing among the swans with a burst of delighted laughter. They laughed as well, all of them, except for their leader. She only continued to watch him as he was passed about from one to the other like a new baby. When the swans were finished, when they sat him down on the water and took up their positions once more, he found himself between them and the lead swan, uncertain, but dizzy with joy and belonging. He took a step toward her, still marveling at how the water was not water, but the most polished marble beneath his feet. The feathers on the swans were not feathers. but fur and cashmere and silk and satin, threaded together, hand-sewn to their disciplined bodies that were designed only for adornment. And his swan. Now, that was how he thought of her and would forever, naming her, claiming her, forgetting already that it hadn't been his privilege to do the choosing, held out her hand. And he took it, as trustingly as a child, mischievously as an imp. Then the swans closed ranks about him, and he was home.
La Côte Basque, October 17th, 1975. He killed her. It's as simple as that. Slim's hands shook as she spilled a packet of menthols all over her plate. Truman killed her. And I'd like to know who the hell it was who befriended that little midget in the first place. It wasn't I, Pamela insisted. I never did like the bugger. Oh, no, it wasn't me. I warned you about him, didn't I? Gloria asked rhetorically. Those Latin eyes flashing so dangerously, it was a good thing there were only butter knives on the table. I don't believe it was me, Marella murmured. No, no, it was not. It sure as hell wasn't me. Slim spat it out. And if he's not convicted for murder, I'm going to sue him for libel, at the very least. The table went silent. This was almost as much of a bombshell as the reason they were gathered in haste, eyes hidden behind dark glasses, as though that could disguise their famous faces. Odd, Slim thought, how they'd all had the same idea, to hide, as if they were the ones at fault, when really, it was Truman who should hide his face, now and forever. But defiantly, they had agreed to meet at the scene of the crime, the restaurant that had spawned the literary scandal of the century, as it was already being called. Slim Hawks Hayward Keith, Marella Agnelli, Gloria Guinness, and Pamela Churchill Hayward Harriman, not a shrinking violet in the bunch, had descended upon La Côte Basque, always the place to see and be seen, especially today. Where's CZ? Gloria asked suddenly. The Honorable Mrs. Guest should be here, too. It only seems right. After all, she was here when it all began. Like it or not, she's one of us. CZ's probably off digging a hole somewhere. Do you know what she did when I called and asked her if she'd read it? She laughed. She laughed. Oh, Slim, she said. If you didn't know by now that Truman Capote couldn't keep a secret, then you're a much bigger fool than I am. Of course, he didn't say a thing about her. But what about? Pamela asked, and they all glanced at the empty chair at the end of the table. Wasn't CZ outraged on her behalf, at least? Slim finally lit the blessed cigarette and took a long draw. She leaned back in her chair and exhaled, narrowing her eyes at Pamela. Strange. How Truman could bring them together. How he'd made allies out of enemies with his pen. She wasn't. Not that I could tell. But Dylan, that odious man in Truman's story, it is Bill, isn't it? It's supposed to be Bill Paley. Slim took a big breath, but couldn't meet her friend's collective searching gaze. Yes, it is. I know it is. Don't ask me how. I just do. Pamela, Gloria, and Marella gasped. So did the other tables nearby. When the four women entered the restaurant together, all heads had turned their way. Some in astonishment, some in outright glee. Others in admiration, but all in curiosity. Marcel, their favorite waiter, cautiously approached the table with the customary bottle of Cristal. He showed it to them, and Gloria wearily waved her hand in assent. He popped the cork, but without the usual flourish. He knew. Everyone knew. The latest issue of Esquire had hit the stands that morning. The cover, a profile picture of a fat and pasty-looking Truman Capote. The headline trumpeting the acclaimed author of In Cold Blood's newest, hotly anticipated short story. La Côte Basque, 1965, it was called. It was now 1 p.m. Liz Smith was probably already on the phone, frantically asking their maids if Madame was in or out. Well, this Madame is out, Slim thought to herself. And she might very well stay out for the rest of the day. Hell, the rest of the night. Where was Papa when she needed him? For she would have hopped the next plane to Cuba, if that were still permissible. And if Hemingway were still alive, daiquiri in one hand, rifle or fly reel in the other, his big, virile, lecherous grin on his face at the sight of her, wondering when the hell he was going to get around to writing a book about her. The most fascinating woman he'd ever met. Ah, but that was another story. From a different time. A different life. Today, the story was different. And it wasn't really her story at all, Slim realized. She had been used, yes. But in the end, her secrets mainly remained intact. Still, that did not dampen her sense of betrayal, her bitterness at what her true heart, her stomach soured at the memory of that pet name, had done. The murder Truman Capote had committed, plain as day, by telling the stories he had told. Stories that he did not have a right to tell. Stories they should never have told him in the first place. No one will return his calls now. No one will invite him anywhere. He's finished in society. Dead. As dead as... Pam dabbed ostentatiously at her blue eyes, which, Slim couldn't help but observe, remained resolutely dry. There was a lull in the conversation. A cloud that dropped over their table, dulling the brilliant light, throwing shadows on the gleaming cutlery, the sparkling crystal. Does anyone really remember when they first met him? Or did he just appear like the plague? Slim was in a reflective mood, one she did not allow herself often, and one that did not sit well with her companions generally. Lunch at La Côte Basque was not for soul-searching. But today was different. Today, they'd opened the pages of Esquire magazine and seen themselves. Not merely themselves, but their kind, their tribe, their exclusive, privileged, envied set, eviscerated, skin flayed open, souls laid bare, ugliness acknowledged, secrets betrayed and lives destroyed, by the viper in their nest, the storyteller in their midst. But Truman Capote wasn't the only one who could tell tales. They decided over another glass of Cristal. So tell me, Slim cooed, her tongue comfortably loose, her throat deliciously numb. How the hell did that southern fried bastard get here in the first place? The four inclined their still gorgeous necks, put their perfectly coiffed heads together in consultation. Beads and feathers quivered on gesticulating arms. Jewels and gold flashed on punctuating hands as they tried to piece it all together. From the very beginning, the story of how Truman Capote came to betray all his swans. But one especially, the one they all loved the most. Even Truman. Especially Truman. The problem with this particular story, however, was that Truman was the one who had told it to them in the first place. Chapter 1. Once upon a time. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. There once was a man from Nantucket. Truman giggled. He covered his mouth like a little boy and tittered until his slender shoulders shook, his blue eyes so gleefully mischievous that he looked like a statue of Pan come to life. Oh, Big Mama, I am such a naughty imp. True Heart, you are priceless. Slim had laughed too, she remembered. Laughed until her ribs ached. Truman did that to her in those glorious early days. He made her laugh. That was it, really. The simple truth of the matter. When he was young, back in 1955, when they were all young, or at least younger, when fame was new and friendships fledgling, fueled by champagne and caviar and gifts from Tiffany's, Truman Capote was a hell of a lot of fun to be around. Once upon a time, Slim had finally pronounced. Yes, well, and Truman drawled it out in his theatrical way, adding several syllables. Once upon a time, there was New York. New York. Stuyvesants and Vanderbilts and Roosevelts and staid, respectable Washington Square. Trinity Church. Mrs. Astor's famous ballroom. The 400, snobby Ward McAllister. That traitor, Edith Wharton. Delmonico's. Zany Zelda and Scott in the Plaza Fountain. The Algonquin Round Table. Dottie Parker and her razor tongue and pen, the Follies, Charlie Knickerbocker, 21, Lucky Strike dances at the Stork, El Morocco, the incomparable Hildegard playing the Persian Room at the Plaza, Cary Grant kneeling at her feet in awe, Fifth Avenue, Henry Bendel, Bergdorf's, Tiffany's. There was a subterranean New York as well. Lower in every meaning of the word. Ellis Island and the Bowery and the Lower East Side. The subway. Automats and shrafts. Hot dogs from a cart. Pizza by the slice. Chickens hanging from windows in Chinatown. Pickles from a barrel on Delancey. Beatniks in the village with their torn stockings and dirty turtlenecks and disdain for everything. But that wasn't the New York that drew the climbers. The dreamers, the hungry. No, it was lofty New York. The city of penthouses and apartments in the St. Regis or the Plaza or the Waldorf. The New York for whom Take the A Train was a song, not an option. The New York of big yellow taxis in a pinch, if the limousine was otherwise occupied. The New York of glittering opening nights at the Met. Endless charity balls and banquets. Wide, clean sidewalks uncluttered by pushcarts and clothing racks and children playing. Views of the park, the river, the bridge. Not sooty brick walls or narrow, dank alleys. The New York of the plays, the movies, the books. The New York of the New Yorker and Vanity Fair and Vogue. It was a beacon, a spire. A beacon on top of a spire. A light always glowing from afar, visible even from the cornfields of Iowa, the foothills of the Dakotas, the deserts of California, the swamps of Louisiana. Beckoning, always beckoning. Summoning the discontented, seducing the dreamers. Those whose blood ran too hot and too quickly, causing them to look about at their placid families. Their staid neighbors, the graves of their slumbering ancestors, and say, I'm different. I'm special. I'm more. They all came to New York. Nancy Gross, nicknamed Slim by her friend, the actor William Powell, from California. Gloria Guinness, La Guinness, born a peasant in a rural village in Mexico. Barbara Cushing, known as Babe from the day she was born, the youngest of three fabulous sisters from Boston. and Truman. Truman Streckfus Persons Capote, who showed up one day on William S. and Babe Paley's private plane, a tag-along guest of their good friends Jennifer Jones and David O. Selznick. Bill Paley, the chairman and founder of CBS, had gaped at the slender young fawn with the big blue eyes and funny voice.
"I thought you meant President Truman,"
he'd hissed to David.
"I've never heard of this little fellow. We have to spend the whole weekend with him?"
Babe Paley, his wife, murmured softly, "Oh, Bill, of course you've heard of him," as she went to greet their unexpected guest with her legendary warmth and graciousness. Of course, Bill Paley had heard of Truman Capote. Who hadn't in Manhattan in 1955?
"Truman, Truman, Truman," voices whispered, hissed, envied, disdained.
Barely 30, the boy wonder, the wunderkind, the tiny terror, this last, however, mainly uttered by other writers, it must be admitted. Truman Capote, slender, wistful bangs and soulful eyes, and unsettling pouty lips, reclining lazily, staring sultrily from the jacket of his first novel, Other Voices, Other Rooms. A novel that neither Babe nor any of her friends, such as Slim or Gloria, had bothered to read, it must be admitted. But still, they whispered his name at cocktail parties, benefits, and luncheons. "You must meet. I'm simply mad about... Of course, you know. Truman."
"I introduced you to him first," Slim reminded Babe after that fateful weekend jaunt to the Paley's home in Jamaica. That startling, stunning weekend when Babe and Truman had found themselves blinking at the first dazzling sunrise of friendship. Still so new that they didn't quite understand that it was friendship. This thing that had cast a spell over the two of them to the exclusion of mere mortals.
"You just don't remember. But he was mine, my true heart. It's not fair that you've stolen him from me." And Slim pouted and shook her blonde hair, always hanging over one eye, looking more like Lauren Bacall than did Lauren Bacall, which was only appropriate, since Lauren Bacall had modeled herself after Slim. Around the time he was working on the screenplay of Beat the Devil, Leland brought him home for dinner one night. "Don't you remember?"
"No, it was I who first discovered him,"
Gloria insisted with a flash of her exotic dark eyes, that flash that always threatened to expose her real origin, concealed so nearly completely beneath the Balenciaga dresses and Kenneth hairstyles and studied British accent.
"I'm surprised, Slim, that you don't recall. It was soon after he adapted The Grass Harp for Broadway. I don't generally go in for Broadway, naturally," she said with an arch look at Slim, who bristled.
"But I'm very glad I went to that opening night. I told you all about him then, Babe."
"My dear, no. I invited him for the weekend in Paris. Don't you recall?"
Pamela broke in, her voice so very, very British, that they all instinctively leaned in to hear her, and they all instinctively recognized the ploy for what it was, and the many times their husbands had done the same thing, only to encounter Pamela's magnificent cleavage displayed in a low-cut Dior.
"Long before any of you, back when he had just published Other Voices, Other Rooms... Bennett Cerf, you know, the publisher."
And she could barely suppress a shudder. One simply did not like to admit one knew those types.
"Asked me if I could entertain this young novelist of his, as he was rather nervous about reviews. You were there, Babe. I'm certain of it."
"Ladies, ladies," admonished CZ, unflappable and untouchable as ever, never quite in, but never quite out of their world. Simple and uncomplicated. A Hitchcock blonde with a sunny smile
and a clenched, exceedingly proper Boston drawl. But CZ, they all knew, was happier puttering around in her garden, spade in hand or tending to her horses, than she was lunching at Le Pavillon. I don't usually care about this sort of thing, but I do believe I was the one who introduced Truman to Babe. We were shopping at Bergdorf's. Truman is marvelous at picking out just the right handbag. You were there that afternoon, Babe.
No, I propose it was on our yacht,
Marella said in her uncertain English. Her entire manner was shy and tentative around her friends, since she was much younger than they were, never entirely sure of her place, despite her fabulous wealth and exquisite beauty. And a face that Truman had pronounced what Botticelli would have created had Botticelli had more talent.
Alec Corda brought him along one summer. I believe you and Bill were there, Babe. Were you not?
Babe Paley, cool in a blue linen Chanel suit that did not crease, no matter the radiator heat of a New York summer, didn't reply. She merely looked on, amused, as she removed her gloves, folded them carefully, and slipped them inside her Hermès alligator bag. Seated in the middle of the best table at Le Pavillon, she surveyed her surroundings. This was her world. A world of quiet elegance, artifice, presentation. And luncheon was the highlight of the day. The reason for getting up in the morning and going to the hairdresser, buying the latest Givenchy or Balenciaga. The reward for managing the perfect house, the perfect children, the perfect husband. And for maintaining the perfect body. After all, one generally dined at home, or at a dinner party. Why else employ a personal chef or two? But one went out for luncheon, at the Colony or Quo Vadis. But especially Le Pavillon, where the owner, Henri Soulet, displayed his society ladies like the objet of fine art that they were, seating them proudly in the front room, spreading them out in plush red velvet banquettes, setting the table with the finest linen, baccarat glasses, exquisite china and silver, and cut crystal bowls of fresh flowers. They drank their favorite wine, pushed the finest French cuisine around their plates. For in order to wear the kind of clothes and possess the kind of cachet to be welcome at Le Pavillon, naturally one could not actually eat. Gossiped and were seen. Photographers were always gathered on the sidewalk outside, waiting to snap the beautiful people inside. And Babe, tall, regal, a gracious smile on her face, was the most sought after of all. To her friend's eternal dismay and to her own weary disdain. Although the most observant, like Slim, might notice that Babe would pause imperceptibly, if no photographer happened to be around, as if looking or wishing for one magically to appear. Why was Babe Paley such a favorite? Why was she the most fussed over, the most sought out for a quick, reverent hello by those not privileged to be seated with her? She was not the most beautiful. That honor must go to Gloria Guinness, with her exquisite neck, lustrous black hair, and flashing eyes. She was not the most amusing. That was Slim Hayward, with her quips and her quick wit, honed at the feet of men like Ernest Hemingway and Howard Hawks and Gary Cooper. She was not the most noble. No, that would be a tie between the Honorable Pamela Digby Churchill, daughter of a baron, ex-daughter-in-law of a prime minister, and Marella Agnelli, a bona fide Italian princess, married to Gianni Agnelli, the heir to the Fiat kingdom. It was her style, that indefinable asset. It was said that the others had style, but Babe was style. No one noticed Babe's clothes, for instance. Not at first, even though she was always clad in the chicest, most exquisite designs. They noticed her. Her tall, slender frame, her grave, dark eyes. the way she had of holding her handbag in the crook of her arm, the simple grace with which she pushed her sunglasses on top of her hair, or unbuttoned a coat with just one hand, allowing it to fall elegantly from her shoulders into the always waiting arms of a maitre d'. What they did not notice was the loneliness that trailed after her, along with the faint grassy scent of her favorite fragrance. Balmain's Vent Vert. The loneliness that despite fabulous wealth, numerous houses, children, the most vibrant and powerful husband of all her friends, was her constant companion. Or, at least, had been. Until now. "It doesn't really matter," Babe finally pronounced, settling it once and for all. "I'm simply so very glad to know him. To Truman." And she raised a flute of crystal. "To Truman," her five friends all echoed. And they toasted to their latest find, excited and hungrily anticipating fresh amusements galore. Nothing more. "To Truman," Babe whispered to herself, and smiled a private little smile that none of her friends had ever seen before. But the Duchess of Windsor had just entered the restaurant. Her harsh little face turned first to the left, then to the right, as if she really were royalty, igniting a small wildfire of catty conversation. "Isn't the Duke the most boring man you've ever met? But those jewels, the one thing he's ever done right." And none of Babe's friends was even looking at her. Except for Slim, who narrowed her eyes and bit her lip, and wondered.
Chapter 2. There was another young woman who dreamed of New York. Another young woman who knew that if she could only find her way there, she could live happily ever after, with or without her young son. Her name was Lily Mae Falk, and she was from Monroeville, Alabama. She came to New York, too.
"Once upon a time,
my mother's name was Nina," Truman told Gloria, told CZ, told Slim. His eyes gleamed softly, reverently. "Nina was beautiful, a real lady. She was too much for Monroeville, Alabama. She always told me, 'Truman, my little man, I'm going to take you to New York one day.' And she did, when I was 11. That's when my life really began, because it's New York. Not sleepy little Monroeville, where nothing ever happened, although I did get bit by a cottonmouth once and nearly died. Nearly. Oh, my goodness. I was 1 foot over the line. But they saved me. Nothing can kill me, not even a snake."
"Oh,"
Slim gasped. Then she grinned.
"Let me see the scar."
"Big Mama." Truman wagged a finger at her, but obliged, rolling up his shirt to reveal a thin, supple arm, paler than the moon, covered with a fine down of silken blonde hair, as white as the hair on his head, the hair brushing his eyes, always falling, falling over his face like a curtain or a veil.
"See?"
Slim did see. Two faint punctures on his forearm, barely visible.
"These are my scars. My only scars," Truman told her triumphantly. "I don't have any others."
"My mother's name was really Lily May," Truman revealed to Babe. It was early in their friendship, those days when they had to catch each other up on everything that had happened to them, so that they could mark their lives. Before and after. "Lily Mae Falk. And she was a selfish bitch," Truman said, his voice flat for once.
He wasn't trying to captivate or ensnare. He knew he had Babe. Knew it in his heart. Knew it as a dream come true. For that was what it was. A beautiful, an exquisite woman. Loving him. Truman. Needing him as he needed her. For what, neither could precisely express just yet. They only recognized each other, not as a reflection in a mirror, but as a reflection of a deeper, darker, murkier sore, or hole, or something gaping but always, always hidden. Until the moment they locked eyes on the CBS plane, each so startled their masks fell, and Truman was, for only a fragment of a moment, no longer the startlingly self-assured prodigy, but a lost little boy, forgotten. And Babe was, beneath the couture and makeup, a shy, unsure woodland creature hugging herself for comfort. Two souls, exposed like raw wounds, visible only to each other, they firmly believed. My mother hated me, despised, loathed. Truman gnashed the words with his teeth. She abandoned me to those horrible cousins in Monroeville, and I thought I'd never see her again. She used to lock me in hotel rooms, did you know? Lock me in while she went off with her gentlemen callers, thank you, Tennessee. And I'd cry and cry, but she'd left instructions, you see. Told the staff not to let me out, no matter how I hollered, and I did. But then I'd finally tire myself out and fall asleep, never knowing when, if, she'd come back for me. Babe was shocked. She wanted to fold her new friend up in her arms, hug him to her heart, which was pierced on his behalf. But she did not. She knew the effort it took to keep one's exterior self together, upright, when everything inside was in pieces, broken beyond repair. One touch, one warm, compassionate hand, could shatter that hard-won, perfect exterior. And then it would take years and years to restore it. So Babe did not hug Truman, who looked, in that moment of confession, as if he were still that 6-year-old boy abandoned by his mother in Monroeville, Alabama. Forgotten by his father, too. Arch Persons. What a farce he was. Is. Someday I'll tell you about him, but not today, Babe dear. I'm a little weary today. And he rubbed his eyes tiredly with his 2 small fists. But she did bring you here, Truman. That's the good thing. The blessed thing. Yes, Lily Mae did get here after all. She married my stepfather, Joe Capote. She changed her name to Nina, and she had a fabulous apartment on Park Avenue, just as she'd dreamed. She finally sent for me and put me in military school. To butch me up. She hated who I was. Called me a fag one moment, then asked me when I'd marry a nice girl the next. She never was proud of me, never. I could have written the Bible, and she'd still call me, to my face, the greatest disappointment in her life. Never. You're no disappointment, Truman. You're a beautiful person, a great artist. You must know that. Well. And Truman did grin up at her. A sly, satisfied little boyish grin. I will admit to overcoming my childhood anyway. The hell that it was. I had the most marvelous childhood. Truman exclaimed to Slim, to Gloria, to CZ, at their parties, where they would surround their new discovery, these glamorous wives of glamorous men, while their husbands looked on in confusion, for they'd never seen a Truman Capote before, and hoped, at first, never to see one again. This tiny, effeminate creature dressed in velvet suits, red socks, an absurdly long scarf, usually wrapped around his throat, trailing after him like a coronation robe, who pronounced, after dinner, "I'm going to sit over here with the rest of the girls and gossip." This pixie, who might suddenly leap into the air, kicking one foot out behind him, exclaiming, "Oh, what fun, fun, fun it is to be me! I'm beside myself!" These men, titans of industry, old money, heirs to fortunes, looked on, agape, and told one another, "Well, at least we don't have anything to worry about from him," as their wives fluttered and cooed and preened and fought to sit next to him. But Truman, watching them, recognizing the sneering disdain and the barely concealed fear in their eyes, smiled to himself, even as he kept chattering to their wives, "These eccentric old cousins who raised me, such material. You've read The Grass Harp, of course. Sook was such a wonderful, crazy old lady. She adored me. They all did. I was the pride of Monroeville, Alabama, the star. And you must meet my friend Nell Harper Lee. She's in New York now, working on a novel about our childhood, apparently, although I'm sure she'll need my help, poor thing. She's bright, but not quite as gifted as moi. But shh, you didn't hear that from me. Nell was my only friend in Monroeville," Truman told Babe bitterly. They were in her bedroom, her sanctum of sanctums, at Killuna Farm. That was her home. Oh, of course, the Paleys had many homes. An apartment in the St. Regis, a summer house in New Hampshire, the beach house in Jamaica. But it was the sprawling estate. 80 acres, Truman exclaimed to his lover, Jack Dunphy, who only grunted and said, "So what?" On Long Island, that was their constant, their true north. After the fateful plane trip, during which the two of them had immediately tumbled into a conversation neither could recall, except for the fact that it seemed to bind them together with an invisible golden thread none of the others present could unravel, Babe immediately invited Truman out for the weekend. She had installed him in a guest room, equipped with a personal valet, fresh flowers, the finest Porto linens, and a view of her spectacular gardens. Truman, after first allowing himself to roll around the plush carpet like a puppy, bounce on the bed like a 10-year-old, and bury his elfin face in the flowers, knocked on her bedroom door and walked right in without waiting for a reply, as if he'd been there 1,000 times before. And Babe, who rarely allowed anyone into her bedroom, smiled and patted the bedspread and found herself, to her amazement, sitting cross-legged next to Truman Capote, who studied her anxiously, his eyes big and blue and innocent. He was like a child at times, she decided, as so many people did upon meeting him. A child who needed reassurance and shelter from the capriciousness of a cruel world. And so she surprised herself by sharing confidences as she had never done before, not even, really, with her two sisters back in Boston. Nell was a tomboy, tough as nails, and she didn't have too many friends herself, plus her mother was crazy as a loon. But she wanted to be a writer, too. We had that in common. No one else in that dusty Alabama town knew what a writer was. But we found an old typewriter in her father's office, and we oiled it up and got some ribbon and would take turns pounding out stories and dialogue and anything that came to mind. We called it going to work. Nell and I wrote ourselves out of Monroeville, since we couldn't very well leave on our own. Lily May went off to New York, divorced my father, married Joe Capote, and still she didn't send for me. Not until I was 11. So I was left to be raised by these kooky old cousins, mocked for my good manners, my nice clothes that Nina sent. Mocked for being me. Smaller than any other boy. Prettier, too. There wasn't a trace of bitterness in Truman's voice. He lolled about the bed, grabbed his knees, and laid his head upon Babe's lap.
"My mother died of pneumonia,"
Truman whispered to Slim, to Gloria, to CZ, to their husbands, now joining their wives by the fire, a cozy, bejeweled, hushed little group surrounding this charming male Scheherazade, with the barest traces of a southern accent, the odd, enchanting lisp, the dreamy eyes, and that hair, fairy hair, spun gold, with long bangs. Men did not have bangs. Men wore their hair slicked back with Brill Cream, no nonsense. But Truman wasn't a man. He wasn't a woman. He was an unearthly creature, a genius. Or so those who weren't inclined to read had been told by those who were. A genius whose eyes were now wet with tears, and their hearts opened to him, as of one accord. "My mother was very young, still beautiful, you know. It was only a couple of years ago. I was in Europe and couldn't get back in time. She died of pneumonia, and she was all alone. And so now I'm an orphan." The wives wiped their own tears. The husbands said to themselves, "Well, he's not so bad after all, the little fellow. I've never been friends with a fag before. What the hell?"
"My mother killed herself,"
Truman told Babe. His eyes were dry and frighteningly clear. "Killed herself with booze and pills. She'd tried before, but always chickened out. But not this time. Old Capote lost all his money, you see. She had nothing. She was back to being Lily May Falk, not glamorous Nina Capote. She couldn't bear it. She couldn't bear me. I was in Europe, working on the script for Beat the Devil, and I had her cremated because she would have hated that. It's so sordid, disgraceful. But now you know." He frowned and sighed, and seemed lost in memories. Babe thought his face most beautiful in repose, when the delicate features, the small yet lusciously red-lipped mouth, the flushed and freckled cheeks, the surprising cleft in his determined jaw, weren't working so hard to beguile. Suddenly he opened his eyes wide and peered up into her face. He smiled that mischievous smile, patted her knee, and cooed, "So now you know about me. All about me. Tell me about you." And Babe felt she had no choice, and didn't want one anyway. This was communion, something of a nature so deep she couldn't articulate it, only feel it rumbling beneath her ribs, tickling her heart. Surface, surface, surface. That was her life, and it had been for as long as she could remember. But here was someone who had bared his soul to her. He had shown her his wounds, his scars, the real ones, the ones that never healed, the ones that weren't visible to the naked eye. So, naturally, she felt she should show him hers as well. A scar for a scar. An eye for an eye. A story for a story. Chapter 3. Once upon a time. With Babe, there was no question. She was a princess, a walking fairy tale. There was no other way to begin her story. Once upon a time there was a beautiful babe, Truman said, prompting. Once upon a time, Babe admitted, smiling shyly, ducking her head. I suppose. It was that, her reticence, he decided. That was what elevated her from woman to goddess, from merely stylish to perfection itself. Her stillness, her grave smile, her quiet voice, her beautiful dark eyes that glittered only to show understanding or reveal some secret hurt, never pride or flirtatiousness. Or even, he thought, sadly, wit. No, Barbara Cushing Mortimer Paley was not a great intellectual. But then, she hadn't been brought up to be one. I was raised to marry well, Babe finally said with a simple, elegant shrug. My mother was a force of nature, although not like yours. She would never have abandoned us. We were her life's work. What was she like? Gogs. That's what we called her after our own children were born, Gogs Cushing. I loved her. That's all. But what was she like? She loved her family. She made a wonderful home for my father, who was always away at work. He was a brain surgeon, you know. He pioneered it, actually. And she taught my sisters and me that if we all stuck together, nothing could stop us or harm us. But, Babe, what was she like? A pill-popper like Nina? A whore like Gloria's mother? Truman! Babe frowned, disapproving, as was only proper. But then she grinned slyly. Gloria? Gloria Guinness? Oh, don't pretend you don't know all about that. Honey, La Guinness was not exactly legitimate, shall we say. Her mother worked the streets in Mexico, of course you know that. Truman, Gloria's my friend, my dear friend, protested Babe with a gentle shake of her head. But Bobolink, darling, you don't mind if I call you that, do you? I have pet names for all my dearest friends. I can't stand formality when the heart is involved, can you? And Babe, who had not been called by her real name for years, yet despised the nickname by which she was so well known, shook her head, touched, and delighted. Now, Bobolink, how can we be friends if we don't gossip together, just a little? Isn't that the most fun ever? Of course we love Gloria, La Guinness. She's divine. But isn't she just a trifle more interesting, knowing that her mother was a whore? Don't you admire her just a bit more when you see how far she had to come to get here? Truman, I've always admired Gloria. She's, well, she's... Detecting the slightest bit of hesitation in Babe's not-quite-so-sympathetic eyes, Truman pounced, like a kitten, dainty claws unsheathed on a caterpillar. What? She's what? Oh, do tell, Babelicious. Oh, that's even better. Do tell. What did Gloria do to you? What did she say? Nothing, Gloria's a dear friend, as I said, but, well, she does have a habit. It's endearing when you think of it. It shows she's still a trifle uncertain of herself, but when she invites Bill and me to join her and Lowell on their yacht every summer, she plays this little game. Yacht? Oh, take me, take me! Truman bounced on his knees, clapping his hands, rumpling the perfection of the satin bedspread, so that Babe bit her lip and practically sat on her own hands to prevent them from immediately restoring it to order. Of course! We'll take you this summer. You'll go with us, Bill and me. It will be tremendous fun. What game? What does Gloria do? Truman immediately sat back down, serious. It's nothing. It's amusing. But she'll tell me, a week before we go, Babe dear, this year we're going to be completely casual. No dressing for dinner. For anything. We'll be wind-blown and fancy-free, so that's how I'll pack. Only casual clothes, leaving most of the jewelry behind, and then, the first night, there I'll be in linen pants and a silk blouse, and Gloria will arrive in the latest Balenciaga gown, draped in jewels from ear to ear. Stunning, of course. And she'll announce that we've been invited to a very formal dinner on shore, and I'll feel like a hobo. Then the next year, I'll fool her. I'll bring only formal clothes and sit down to dinner so elegant you could die, and Gloria will show up in pants and a blouse, her hair tied back with a scarf, and she'll say, "Why so formal, babe? It's a yacht, not Maxime's. Where do you think you're going?" Babe laughed, a good, hearty chuckle, completely at odds with her porcelain perfection. But Truman detected the exasperation in her eyes, and his own gleamed with catty delight. That's priceless. And horrid. Yes, it shows how insecure she must be, despite all of Lowell's fabulous wealth. Gloria's my friend, Babe reminded him. His heart thrilled to her voice. It was so low, gentle, soothing. Nothing could ruffle it, he thought. Nothing could ruffle her. But then the clock on her mantle struck 7 soft, discreet chimes, and suddenly Babe Paley was not unruffled. Panic flared in her eyes as she turned in horror to the clock. Her hands reached out in the first abrupt, involuntary gesture he had seen from her. Oh, it can't be 7, it simply can't be. So? But Bill will be home any minute, and I'm not ready to greet him. Babe slid down from the bed and walked, gracefully, with her shoulders squared and straight, her long legs as strong yet supple as a ballerina's, to her dressing room. Truman jumped down off the bed and capered after her. Oh, Babe, what an Aladdin's cave! He looked around in awe. Babe Paley's dressing room was nearly as big as her bedroom and decorated in the same pattern of chintz from ceiling to floor. Her vanity was enormous, draped in beautiful pink fabric that echoed the chintz and covered with crystal perfume flacons, powder puffs, mirrored trays, bottles of makeup devoid of any trace of fingerprints or smudges. Silver-plated brushes, both hairbrushes and makeup brushes, several mirrors of different sizes, handheld, upright, lighted. Babe was seated on the vanity stool, studying herself in the largest mirror with the intensity of an artist assessing his just-finished painting. "You look perfect," Truman soothed her, sensing his role. But Babe shook her head. I always remove my makeup and reapply it just for him, but now I don't have time. There's no need, Truman insisted, putting his hands on her shoulders and peering into the mirror, gazing at the apparition before him. She must be 40, he thought, but her face,
did not give away such sordid secrets. Babe was not a natural beauty, although you sensed that she had the potential to be. But